From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we talk about Republicans in the legislature who want to take away a reason for some voters to go to the polls in November.
You know, the increased turnout because of recreational use of marijuana being on the ballot is just going to be on the margins, I think.
We'll talk with the people trying to treat immigrants from war zones.
One third of the adults screen positive for PTSD. That's comparable to Vietnam War veterans.
Stink bugs are not only a nuisance, they're damaging crops.
We can't really track it as well until it already shows up and starts damage. So it's hard to be really preventative with this particular pest.
And a newly invented cocktail to celebrate a Michigan distiller's success.
What I started off thinking about is that Akavit has that caraway flavor, which means some people love it and some people hate it because it reminds them of rye bread.
All of that and Rick Pluta. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's April 20th, 420, which is a significant date for some folks. I thought I'd mark it by talking to Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, which is always a trip. Rick, I've been listening to and reading the reporting on the Michigan Medical Marijuana Licensing Board. Here we are, 16 months after lawmakers approved regulating and taxing the medical marijuana industry, and not a single license issued. That's after a fair number of years of dispensaries popping up for business just about anywhere the proprietors wanted. What's the holdup here?
Well, the holdup is that they've been setting this up for so long that they've just now started executing the standards that the legislature adopted. And the issue here is that some people say that the board and the state medical marijuana regulating agency are just being a little too laid back on this, that there are 470-something applications pending. And yesterday, the board, the marijuana licensing board, issued just 9 preliminary licenses, which means that they haven't even gotten around to issuing a finalized license to a single medical marijuana business, with the deadline to get all of them done less than 2 months away.
How long ago did the board start accepting applications?
Applications started coming in December of last year. That the deadline was mid-February to get that in. And if you didn't, and you were an existing medical marijuana facility, then you got a cease and desist order from the state saying that you're no longer eligible to operate. And the fact that if you continue to operate, then that might affect your future ability to get a medical marijuana license.
The ballot initiative legalizing medical marijuana in Michigan was passed in November of 2008. That's almost a decade ago. Why has it taken so long to get around to regulating this industry?
Well, the medical marijuana law, as it was adopted by voters, was actually very confusing. And it just took that long for local governments to sort out what they wanted to do, going to the legislature, having the legislature muster up the will to try and deal with this. And remember, because this was a voter-adopted initiative, that it actually takes super majorities in the legislature to change it. So a lot of this was just the time that it took to develop a willingness to exercise the political will to get this done.
You know, if a person were the suspicious type, you might think the government is using the Michigan Medical Marijuana Licensing Board to slow down or stop medical marijuana dispensaries altogether, or would that be paranoid?
maybe you were trying out some of the product?
Not me personally, but I'm just asking a question here.
Well, part of the problem here is that there is, in fact, a June 15th deadline for the board to issue finalized licenses to applicants who have followed the rules. Now, the board seems to have sort of tacitly, or at least the agency seems to have tacitly acknowledged that it's not likely to hit that target with all of the licensing, all of the applications that are still outstanding. And so what they've said is, while operating after June 15th, if you haven't been issued a final license, might affect your business, that the agency is not going to, it's not going to issue any cease and desist orders, and it's not going to refer anything to the state police for some kind of legal action.
So is this a matter of that background checks just take a long time, or is there something else going on here?
It's a matter of background checks take a long time, and a lot of it, according to the agency, is this is uncharted territory, and a lot of it was just the agency learning how to do its job. And as they've gotten into the process more and more, they've developed methods and systems that are working for them that should speed up the process. But as one person who showed up at the board meeting yesterday pointed out, that in 2 months you'd have to have like 48 meetings if you're going to process all of them at a rate something like 9 or 10 per meeting.
That is Rick Pluta. He covers the Capitol for Michigan Radio. Rick, I know you probably have a safety meeting to get to. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's a big day. Stuff to do.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. This is a different setup. I don't see a recipe here.
That's right. So our friends out at Long Road Distillers in Grand Rapids just won a big award. They were named best of class for their old Akavit at the American Distillers Institute conference. And so I decided that we should do something a little different to celebrate that award.
Tell me what Akavit is.
So Akavit is a... is sort of like gin in that it starts off with a neutral spirit, but then where gin is flavored with juniper, Akavit's main botanical is caraway.
So this is something that's popular in Scandinavia.
That's right. Norway, Denmark, Finland, Iceland.
Okay, so what's your idea here?
Well, so what I thought we would do is actually sort of go through the process of developing a cocktail while we mixed it. So
we're winging it.
We're winging it.
Or
yeah.
You are.
Well, people often ask, you know, how do you come up with cocktail recipes? A lot of times I use recipes that other people have developed, but I like playing around and developing my own recipes, and I know other people like to play around with that at home, so I thought it would just be a fun thing to kind of go through my thought process, and then we'll see if this drink's any good. All right, so what I started off thinking about is that Akavit has that caraway flavor, which means some people love it and some people hate it because it reminds them of rye bread. So I like rye bread, and I like rye bread with caraway, so I thought, all right, I'm going to start with some Akavit, and I'm going to put an ounce of that here in my mixing glass. This is going to be sort of an old-fashioned style cocktail, so it's going to be stirred, not shaken. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to take that rye idea, and I'm just going to play that up, and I'm going to add an ounce of the Long Road rye whiskey to go along with that ounce of their old Akavit.
Oh, that's a shame. The bottle's almost empty.
Yeah, right. We're using it up, so this drink better be good because we won't be able to make it again. All right, so then, little known fact, rye's cousin pumpernickel, which is that dark rye bread, is colored with cocoa powder. That's where it gets its dark color from.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So I thought, all right, how about some creme de cacao? So, you know, I tend to be kind of a thinky cocktail maker. So sometimes I'm working off flavors together, but sometimes I'm also just looking for associations of what reminds me of different things and can I put those together. So I added just a half an ounce of that. So that's going to act as our sweetener for this drink, as well as giving it some flavor notes. And then I'm going to try a couple dashes of Peychaud's bitters. So Peychaud's are the classic New Orleans bitters. They are really common in Sazerac, so we know they go well with rye whiskey. They have some caraway and anise notes to them, so they're going to kind of amp up that character from the Akavit. So a couple dashes of those. And I'm going to add some ice to my mixing glass. And stir, stir, stir. It's important when making a drink like this to stir it long enough, because otherwise if the liquids don't get diluted and chilled enough, the drink can be kind of syrupy. So we really want to make sure that we stir this for a while. All right, so I'm going to take a little sip now before I put it into the glass, because this is my chance to test, is it right? Does it need a little bit more sweetness? Is there anything I can do to tweak it? I'm going to stir it a little longer because it's still a little strong. This is an old-fashioned style drink, so it's going to continue to change once we get it into the glass. All right, I think this is interesting. It's definitely not going to be for everyone. So I'm going to transfer it to my glass now. And then a thing that makes a huge difference in cocktails is the garnish. And with old-fashioned style drinks, we usually garnish that with a citrus twist. And I don't really have a logic behind this one, but just lemon is what I thought would go well with these ingredients.
It's classic.
So I'm going to get a nice big wide lemon twist here and squeeze that over the top of the glass. I'm actually going to wipe it around the rim to really get that flavor for the person who's drinking it.
So that expresses the oils of the orange?
That's right.
Lemon peel?
Okay. Right. So we're taking the oils from the peel and getting them onto the top of that drink. So the first thing you're going to experience when you bring this to your nose is the lemon oil. And then under that, you're probably going to pick up some of these caraway notes. And then the chocolate from the creme de cacao is probably going to come in kind of at the end as kind of a base note. So, all right, Lester, tell me what you think of our experiment.
Here's what I want to know. Do you name these before you finish them, or do you name them after you got exactly what you want?
Sometimes I come up with a name and then figure out how to make a cocktail that matches that name. But in this case, I don't have an idea for this yet. So you could have the honors if you want them.
Okay, well, we'll see. I might not be that creative. Nothing like what I expected.
In a good way or a bad way?
No, in a good way. It's a little sweet to me, a little syrupy, but the flavor is a nice mix of those three spirits that you use. That's just, I didn't think that would work, actually, and it does. I think I would stir it even longer.
Dial back that creme de cacao a little bit. So we did a whole half ounce, and so you could go with a quarter ounce or just, you know, what they call a fat quarter, so just a smidge over that quarter line to try to bring it more in line with your taste.
I call it a success, so what are we going to name it?
We could call it success.
That works for me.
Cheers.
Coming up, is Michigan on the brink of an all-out stink bug invasion?
This bug likes to hide in cracks and crevices and wooden crates and shipping materials, and that's how we share lots of invasive pests back and forth around the world.
You know, we will be using anything we can to control it that is legally available, because it is a pest and it will cause massive damage if we don't control it.
That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Some refugees from desperate situations around the world are fortunate enough to be accepted into the U.S., but then what? If you've been in a war-torn area or a victim of torture, you're glad to be safer, but you're in a strange country. You likely don't speak English. You don't understand the bureaucracy, the medical system, and you're probably going to land in a sketchy neighborhood. Then there's the chance you're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or other issues, but you don't know that because you've never been diagnosed and you might not even be familiar with the concept of PTSD or depression. Our guests today have taken it upon themselves to help with some of those challenges. Dr. Aresh Javanbak is the director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University's Department of Psychology. And Mohammed Al-Saud is a research assistant at the clinic. Welcome to both of you. Sorry for butchering your name.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what prompted each of you to decide to work with refugees?
So we have this anxiety and trauma clinic at Wayne State University, and it's a research clinic. And Michigan hosts a large, used to host actually until a couple of years ago, a large group of refugees coming from the Middle East. One reason is that Michigan is a refugee-friendly state. At the same time, there's a large Arab community in Michigan. So it would feel more familiar with a lot of refugees to come to Michigan. So these refugees from Syria and Iraq have gone through very difficult situations, right? Situation in Syria before this was very stable, like here. Like one morning you wake up and you see that neighbors are being killed by other people that you don't even know. Your water is shut down. You don't have electricity. For day-to-day access to grocery or healthy water, you have to struggle. And you don't know if tomorrow you or one of your relatives or family members would be alive or not. And then if you get very lucky, you can get out of the country and be in a camp where you have to stay for a couple of years before you're vetted and you can come to a country like the United States. There was reports before this work that there's a high level of impact of traumatic experiences in refugees who are in Middle Eastern camps or in Syria. But we didn't have data about what's going on with them when they come to a safe country like America. So here they're far from the conflict zone. They have been away for about a couple of years. Some could argue that, well, so probably all the problems and issues and stresses are gone. But at the same time,
this stuff doesn't heal itself by itself.
Exactly. In our clinic, we have seen people who were traumatized years ago. They still carry the severe symptoms of trauma. So we decided to screen Syrian refugees and Iraqi refugees for usual common consequences of trauma and stress, including anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. Before getting there, let me just quickly say what is post-traumatic stress disorder, because to a lot of people, it's a concept. As you mentioned, a lot of refugees would not probably even know what this is. It's a condition that happens when people are exposed to extreme life-threatening situations of trauma, such as war, assault, car accidents, rape, gunshots, robbery, these situations, which can lead to symptoms of always being anxious, always being on the alert. The brain wants to protect the person against that situation happening again. And nightmares, flashbacks, and being socially isolated, very difficult situation. That often comes with depression and anxiety.
I want to ask Mohammed, you've actually worked with these people before you came to the U.S. You've worked with refugees in other situations. What did you learn in those experiences that you're bringing to this work now?
Well, I started working with refugees in 2005. I'm originally from Iraq. Once I left Iraq to Jordan, there was a flood of displaced people moving to Jordan, trying to settle there or just as transient point. At the time, there were many organizations and American universities conducting research in the field of psychiatry. The main goal of the research at the time in 2005 and 2006 was understanding the acceptance level of having a mental issue, along with how accessible help for each refugee is available in case they need one. We worked over the period of 2 years. At the time, we interviewed approximately between 500 to 600 refugees. At the time, we were surprised by how they were accepting the fact that it's not a stigma to have mental illness, although it is a stigma to go public with it. So it was a matter of like the society point of view more than the personal point of view for the disease or any issue they complain from.
Is that the case with the people you're working with now as well?
Yeah. At least my opinion.
Let's talk about some of the work that's actually happening. How many refugees have you assessed?
So Arab American Chaldean Council has clinics in Dearborn and Detroit metro area. Every refugee that walks into the United States has to do a physical health screening within the first month of their arrival. So our department had a good relationship with this nonprofit, ACC, and Mohammed and his team go to the ACC clinics every time a new refugee family comes in, and the doctor at the ACC tells them about this research study, and if they're interested, they will join our team for screening. We have been lucky that we have screened more than 94 or 5% of the refugees who were referred to us.
I'm sorry, what was the figure again?
94% of refugees.
Wow.
And that's important because it shows that it's a good representative of the total sample. So we screen for PTSD, anxiety, depression. We also look at some biological markers like genetics and inflammation. Unfortunately, the impact is high, very similar to what was found in the Middle East among refugees in the Middle East.
What kind of percentage?
1/3 of the adults screen positive for PTSD. That's comparable to Vietnam War veterans' lifetime PTSD rate. Nearly 50% screen positive for depression and anxiety. Same in children. In children, we don't see presentations of stress as much in the form of PTSD as we would see in adults, but we see more of anxiety. Nearly 60% of kids have high anxiety, and nearly 80% have separation anxiety, which makes it very difficult for a kid to want to separate from parents and go to school, go to explore, go to sleepovers, go to parties. So numbers are high.
You have a higher ratio of kids than adults, or how's that mix?
In terms of numbers?
Yeah.
Relatively similar. It seems like relatively each family has two kids. And these are families which most of these kids have both of their parents. So these are the luckiest kids, because a lot of kids lost a parent, lost a family member, lost both of their parents through the transition and through the war.
If you want a better idea about the numbers, we interviewed 125 families so far in phase one, which is in total 486 individuals. The flow of refugees has slowed down since last year.
Since Trump was elected. You
know. Our plan was to continue collecting data, and then with the new administration policies, the flow of refugees significantly slowed down.
So once you make an assessment, then what happens?
So one part is like showing the impact, because if, let's say, 2% of the people are impacted, among 1,000 refugees, you would have 20 people who would need care. If it's 30%, it would be 300 people who need care. So this is the first step in need assessment. Then it comes to intervention. So it's also good for science, right? Because we are looking at the genetic, epigenetics, inflammation markers, a lot of research that we do about trauma to know what are the underlying neurobiological mechanisms of trauma and how we can address them in treatment. The next step would be intervention. How do we want to help these people? Because, well, it's sad news that the impact is so high. But the good news is that we have treatments. We have interventions. We can change people's lives, because these are very debilitating situations. And with treatment, person can be very more able to assimilate and go through the stress of new environment. So we have launched an intervention work. Traditional psychotherapy or medication treatments would be very difficult in this population, because number one, acceptance of the stigma of mental illness or medications is difficult. Besides, we don't have enough skilled therapists who are fluent in the culture and language.
Right.
So we launched this study where we bring a family, a mom and a child, and we recently started adding dads. Moms do mindful yoga and kids do art and dance therapy. It's basically a collaboration of many different parties, people from art school in the university, our department, Samaritas, which is a social service that provides transportation for free for the refugees. And we have been seeing good effects. Actually, Muhammad has been involved on the field, and he can tell you some of the experiences he has had.
So what are you doing for the dads?
For the dads, we have a new thing going on right now, which is high-intensity interval training in an attempt to decide whether it's useful or not for relief of stress and anxiety and what's the effect of it.
So this art therapy, dance therapy, what did you call it again? High-intensity interval training, okay. Is that as effective as counseling or medication?
So, number one is that, can you get the medication and counseling to this population? In general, we don't have enough therapists who are familiar with treatment of trauma and PTSD, even for American citizens. So it will be much more complicated when you want to bring people who know the language and the culture. With these interventions, there's evidence from previous studies that they work, but those evidences are mostly qualitative. So we, because we are a research clinic, we are not only doing the intervention, but also brought a research component to this. So we measure the stress level before and after the interventions. We also look at inflammation markers, because inflammation is something which is in the body and in the brain when these conditions happen. I just was looking at some of our data because the first was the feasibility. Would we be even able to bring these families to this, into these interventions, as you mentioned? So how much is the acceptance? Acceptance has been actually good. It also helps them do community building and become friends. And gradually, we had, like, in our first phase, has like 4 moms leave our intervention. Why? Because they found jobs, which was exciting to us. Anyway, so we have found decline, and we have enough numbers in children to look at the effects. We have had significant decline in distress and anxiety among children. Now we're looking at the adults.
Let's talk about the research, and I assume you've been publishing on this. What are your peers saying? I mean, this is fairly unique in the nation, right? And there are other populations of refugees around the nation. Are your peers looking at this and saying, okay, now we've got some direction?
Yes. So actually, other people are slowly joining our intervention and research, actually. So we had another researcher from our university, another department, joined us to now look at like intergenerational transfer of trauma, like kids who were born after migration while mom was pregnant during the transition. How did mom's stress affect the infant? We also have been talking to people in Toronto, our colleagues in Toronto who are interested in implementing our intervention studies. Besides that, there's a National Psychiatric Genetic Consortium, which is trying to poll a large group of people who are traumatized from all different backgrounds to look at the genetic vulnerabilities. So we are the first Middle Eastern population that joined this effort to, because this is a very unique genetically and ethnic group that we don't know the differences in genetic vulnerability compared to Caucasian and African American population that we have mostly in those cohorts. We are also aware of other groups which are focusing on interventions and access to treatment.
So what's next for you guys?
So next is that we have established what was the impact of trauma when people came here. But then when you put a diagnosis for PTSD or depression on the person, it doesn't mean that they are marrying them to that diagnosis. That can change. So after a year, Mohammed and his team have started collecting data again on the same people to see what was the trajectory of symptoms. How did the symptoms in these people change, specifically kids, because childhood trauma is very important in adults' mental and physical health. And then we are looking at psychological, inflammation, genetics, and environmental factors which can impact that trajectory so that we can identify those factors which are more important to be priorities to address. Because in 10, 15, 20 years, this kid is going to be an American adult citizen, right? And do we want him to be a successful, productive member of the society who is symptom-free and can contribute? Or do we want them to be the person who carried this trauma throughout their adulthood and was impacted all these years by it?
Arash Javanbak is the director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University. Mohammed Al Saud is a research assistant at the clinic. Thanks for coming in and telling us about your work.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
The team at Wayne State is trying to figure out whether alternative therapies for stress and anxiety, think exercise or breathing techniques, can help refugees who have resettled in Southeast Michigan. Stateside Sarah Leeson went to a yoga and movement therapy session at Hype Athletics in Dearborn Heights. She brought us back this audio postcard.
So we're going to start in a seated posture, and just want you to take a breath in and breathing out. Just sitting up nice and tall and just noticing how you're feeling today. And the mantra I like to use for this to kind of anchor my mind down is, that was then, this is now. My name is Lisa Malinowski, and I am a yoga instructor and mindfulness educator. And today I'm here helping out with the project at Wayne State and just teaching yoga to these lovely women that are here.
And then slowly coming back down into hands and knees, tabletop. And then let's inhale, lift our hearts off the bellies. And exhale, pressing into your palms.
Dropping. I teach in the sense that it's trauma-informed, right? So these women have experienced something that I have never experienced personally in my life. But it's a powerful program. I think the ability to have this tool as someone who has experienced possibly such high levels of trauma in their lives, and to be able to have this safe space and learn how to be okay with feelings and uneasiness and change, and that really might benefit from this and find some peace in their future.
I'm Jenna Spinay. I am a dance movement psychotherapist, and I hold the movement therapy sessions here.
We're gonna play musical chairs right here, so you might want to get out of
there. We play like 7-Up, and they're like tag, and we play a lot of games.
The first day was chaos and madness, as it always is, and really fragmented. And then over the weeks, I've just seen it increase exponentially each time, like the amount of community, that we have in the space. And a lot of times they're introducing and requesting games that they remember playing at home, and then they'll teach them to each other and they'll play them together, and that's really lovely to see. And they're all movement games, of course, because you can play those anywhere. So that's been fun for me to learn and see, like, oh, I know that game, but I know it by a different name, and oh, the rules are kind of different, but let's play it together. And sometimes it brings up stories from home, and I remember one time when we played this game, so that's really nice to see.
My name is Ali Sayed. I'm the founder and CEO of Hype Athletics Community. You know, we all study human development. You have, you know, the mental, the cognitive, the physical, and the emotional, as well as the spiritual. So there's five major components. And physical development is definitely one that, you know, kids lack, especially in their upbringing. If they're in the middle of a war, you know, there's nothing that they can do for fun, you know. And that sort of takes their mind away from their negative thoughts and whatnot. But, you know, I've definitely have been able to witness the smiles on the kids' face, the excitement from even when they receive a snack to when they're going on the basketball courts to play basketball. The kids that I've had a chance to meet are just, you know, they're just innocent. You can tell. They just want to have fun like every other kid, you know. Just the way that they're gonna get to that fun is going to be a little bit of a challenge, but we'll make it happen.
Still to come, would the legislature legalizing recreational pot in Michigan prevent a Democratic wave at the polls in November? That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Have you seen any stink bugs in your home? The last few years, the brown marmorated stink bug has invaded the southern half of the Lower Peninsula, and they're more than just a nuisance. They're a threat to crops. Joining me to talk about that are Amy Irish Brown. She's a senior educator at the Michigan State University Extension, and Jim Engelsma. He's president of J. Engelsma Orchards Incorporated. Amy, how much of a threat are the stink bugs to crops?
We're still in the low population phase, so I would say they're not a huge threat at this time. However, other states that have been dealing with them for over 10 years now have seen some devastating results. Apple orchards in the east have had damage upwards of 60% and 70%. So we're kind of, our numbers are higher. We're past the watchful waiting phase, and a few growers last year had to take some steps to manage them a bit, but we're just kind of on the lookout.
Jim, I understand you're one of those farmers. You've had some crop loss. What kind and how extensive?
Well, we've been watching this come in for the last few years, and like Amy said, it started at a kind of a low ebb, and then it's picked up a little speed. I'm a little closer to the city than a lot of growers, the city of Grand Rapids, and I was, 2 years ago, I had some pretty substantial damage on the back sides of my orchards where they run up to the wood line. We've, you know, monitored them and been able to control them, but it's something that is going to affect us in the future here, and we're going to have to be very vigilant.
Let me back up. Do farms closer to cities, are they at higher risk?
The brown marmorated stink bug overwinters well in homes and in businesses where there's warmth. So the closer you are to a metropolis, yeah, there's more pressure for sure. I think Amy would agree with that.
I do agree with that, and it's something we've seen across the country where this pest first came into the New Jersey area, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago. The exact same process happens. It starts in urban areas and moves outward to crop areas from there.
What do these stink bugs tend to eat?
They pretty much can eat almost anything. They have a huge host range, which also makes them very difficult for us to monitor. I work with fruit growers and in their pest management programs, and we try to use integrated pest management, which means you're using all available tools to make decisions. And one of those important tools is monitoring. And this particular bug kind of makes me pull my hair out a little bit because it's very difficult to monitor because, you know, when it decides it wants to move into apples, It just does, and it's feeding on something else all summer long, and we can't really track it as well until it already shows up and starts damage. So it's hard to be really preventative with this particular pest, but we're doing lots of work with Michigan State University, and other universities actually are all working together to try to find a better trap and a better way of monitoring.
You mentioned integrated pest management. A lot of orchards and other farms have been moving toward that method. Are there natural enemies or ways to trap this bug or natural occurring mixes that will keep these stink bugs from doing so much damage?
There is a particular parasitic wasp that feeds on the eggs of brown marmorated stink bug. This is we call it an invasive pest, and it came to us from Asia. And what happens sometimes is when that occurs, it doesn't bring its natural enemies with it. It shows up here and nothing can stop it. So the federal government and APHIS will go back to its point of origin and try to find, you know, do sampling and find natural enemies. And they've done that. They found this parasitic wasp, and it's still in they have to vet that before they can release it to make sure it doesn't harm anything else. And we're in that process right now. But in the meantime, this natural egg parasite has kind of showed up on its own in some areas. So I'll be working with a team at MSU this year to do a large-scale sampling of brown marmorated stink bug populations in Michigan to see if we can just find that parasite. And if we do, we can rear it and release it and try to curb the explosion of this particular pest, which is how it'll work out in the end.
I just want to clarify, this parasitic wasp, it's a naturally occurring wasp. It's native to this area?
It's not native to the United States. It's native to Asia, where the brown marmorated stink bug comes from.
So introducing a new bug to get rid of another bug, that sometimes goes awry.
And that's why when we introduce something from another country, it has to go through many years, like 6 or 8 years of testing to make sure it doesn't have some alter ego and starts infesting some other crop. It's not likely to happen with this particular wasp because it's an egg parasite, but the U.S. government will do due diligence to make sure that isn't going to happen. But in the meantime, like I said, it's kind of shown up naturally with the population. So perhaps, I mean, that's how we got brown marmorated stink bug. It showed up with probably packing materials and, you know, maybe even on plant materials. Not everything gets inspected, and this bug likes to hide in cracks and crevices and wooden crates and shipping materials, and that's how we share lots of invasive pests back and forth around the world.
Jim, this is not the first pest to come into the country because of global trade. Is this just part of the price of international free markets?
Well, it truly is part of the price, but it's not something that we welcome. You know, we can't change the fact that this happens, but it definitely is a game changer in how we, you know, approach the IPM methods. Like Amy said beforehand, this really puts a strain on everything we do.
Most orchards these days try to limit pesticides and insecticides to the very minimum. Is that something that might have to return or be used more often?
You know, that's always the goal, not only for cost, but it's also for, you know, the safe food that we have in America. And it definitely will affect the chemistry amounts that we use, but it will not change the safety of the food because we have to work in those parameters. So, you know, we will be using anything we can to control it that is legally available, because it is a pest and it will cause massive damage if we don't control it. So, but I think it will be, you know, done in a very premeditated way that will not cause us to go downhill in the fact that, you know, we have the safest food in the world.
Let's talk about how bad this is right now and how bad it could be. I mean, what's the economic toll statewide so far, and what could it be in the future?
As I mentioned right from the get-go, you know, I've told my growers, last year we passed the watchful waiting phase, so we're still really at the very beginning of seeing this pest explode in numbers compared to areas along the eastern seaboard where they've had devastating losses. However, we are at a little bit of an advantage because we learned from them, you know, on previous occurrences, and so we are trapping extensively to try and monitor what's going on. some growers, I think Jim is one of them, that, you know, near urban areas and what we would call hot spots, maybe more southwestern part of Michigan, have seen some losses, probably upwards of 20 or 25%, or probably even higher if they got caught off guard one season, and then they try to step up the game and monitor better and manage it. So I think overall, in the whole state of Michigan, is probably less than 1% damage, but for the individual growers that have dealt with this emerging pest and the increasing populations, they've already seen some economic losses.
Jim, 25% crop loss, that sounds pretty significant to me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have to be realistic. There's borders that can have, you know, these high numbers of crop loss. And when we have this, these apples still can be used. Usually it's a marring of the finish of the fruit, and the apples can still be used for apple juice or apple cider, because it's really a injury that's just corked a little bit of skin and flesh. It is not like total destruction of the piece of fruit. There's no insect when they leave the fruit. There's just a little dry damage where they, you know, sucked a little juice out of the apple. So these fruits can be used. But we do not want to go where the East Coast went. We will monitor. I think monitoring, Amy has stressed the importance of monitoring, and we really have stepped up our game on monitoring. It's the only way you can really know if they're in the neighborhood. So, you know, that's a big part of it. And the damage so far has not been large over the state of Michigan. Exactly as Amy said, it's been these little pockets where, you know, a grower might be close to a woodline or he might be closer than average. I have two growers around me that have suffered a little damage here and there, and it's just really concerning to them, but the dollar amount loss has not hit us like it devastated the East Coast some years ago. Not yet.
Jim Engelsma is president of J. Engelsma Orchards and a consultant with Crop Production Services. Amy Irish Brown is with MSU Extension. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, let's get some opinions on a couple of things happening in Lansing with our Friday commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. It looks like legalizing marijuana for recreational use will be on the ballot in November. And if the polls are correct, more than 60% of voters are okay with recreational use of pot. This week, the It's Just Politics team talked about how Republicans, even some of those who don't like the idea of legalizing marijuana, might go ahead and pass it in the legislature anyway. The idea is to give progressive voters one less reason to go to the polls in the fall. Vicki, politically, does that make sense?
Once in a while, it does make sense. I think the legislative reasoning this year is quite off. Progressives have every reason in the world to continue to turn out at the polls. And in fact, at the Democratic endorsement convention last weekend, we had over 6,500 delegates show up to cast ballots for endorsing Secretary of State candidate, Supreme Court candidates, and the Attorney General candidate. So I don't think there's much that can be done to stop progressives and activists from showing up at the polls this year.
How does that number compare to conventions of a similar nature?
Well over double.
Oh, wow. Ken, what do you think of this maneuver by the legislature or this proposal?
Well, what's kind of given some impetus to it is what Republican legislators did in 2006 and 2014 dealing with minimum wage, where in both cases, both years, you had ballot initiatives, signatures being gotten to put this on the ballot, and Republican legislature said, look, let's just pass a minimum wage increase and keep it off the ballot so you don't have that kind of turnout. I don't think they're going to do that this year on this recreational use of marijuana. These are very different issues. And, you know, the minimum wage, I mean, you already had a minimum wage, and the debate was, you know, should it be raised? But recreational use of marijuana is just a much, much bigger issue that I think resonates more with conservatives in primaries for Republicans, meaning they'd be against it. So I just think it's an apples and oranges comparison. And I agree with Vicky. I think this concept that you are worried about turnout, there's going to be a fairly high Democratic turnout anyway for all kinds of reasons. You know, the increased turnout because of recreational use of marijuana being on the ballot is just going to be on the margins, I think.
I'll just say, I wonder if the Republicans are overthinking this one. I know a lot of middle-aged and older Republican voting citizens who are enthusiastic about legalizing pot, so this bit of politics by the Republican legislators just might be a miscalculation, in my view. It looks like the standards for an election recount might be changing. In 2016, even though she lost in a big way, the Green Party's presidential candidate, Jill Stein, asked for and got a recount of the Michigan vote after Michigan went for Donald Trump. Legislation would require a candidate to prove they have a reasonable chance at winning before getting a recount if this legislation is passed and signed. Vicky, what do you make of that proposed standard?
Well, I think that every candidate should be able to request a recount should he or she wish one. The question is the cost of the recount, who's going to pay for it, and the likely outcome in the Jill Stein case, it was somewhat frivolous, but we learned a lot about how to protect the ballots, how to fix ballot boxes when there were problems in the voting. I can't remember the exact number, but a lot of precincts in Detroit were unrecountable, and in other parts of the state, they couldn't be recounted either. So we've learned a lot, and I don't want to discount that and the right of individuals who put their name on the ballot to request whatever is available to them. The cost, however, is really an issue because the cost falls upon the state or the local jurisdiction should the cost be too low to not actually capture the true value of what it costs to do a recount. In that case, I'm fully in favor of doubling the recount cost in cases where there is 5% or more discrepancy between the winners and the losers in terms of vote total. And that bill sailed through this week as well, and that one makes the cost of a recount much more expensive but much more realistic to take the onus off of the voting public.
Ken, right now all you have to do is claim that there might have been mistakes or believe there was fraud. That 2016 recount, as Vicky was talking about, showed some weaknesses in our voting system. What do you think of this legislation?
Well, Jill Stein back in 2016 got less than 2% of the vote in Michigan, and she forced a recount, which, you know, the cost of which really fell mostly on local jurisdictions rather than the state. So this bill going through the legislature and apparently going to the governor's desk to, you know, make some correction, I think is a good bill. You don't want to make recounts too onerous, but I just think what she did was so irresponsible that it's got to be corrected. The taxpayers shouldn't be paying for frivolous recounts.
Do either of you know how this compares to other states?
No.
No, I don't. I mean, you know, most of these recounts.
Scratch that question.
Most of these are going to be at the local level, or they're going to be for, you know, smaller races, not presidential races. They're not. Most of them aren't going to be statewide. They're going to be state rep, state senate, county commission, and, you know, you might have close votes there. I mean, when I got elected in '86, there were some very close elections, and I talked to a state rep who got elected a couple years earlier who won by 5 votes. So, like I said, you don't want to make the process for recounts onerous. But what Jill Stein forced taxpayers to do in Michigan a couple of years ago was just irresponsible.
It was not only irresponsible, it was an egregious misuse of the process. And I think that's what people are reacting to. I personally remember losing a state Senate primary in 2014 by 117 votes out of hundreds thousands cast. So it is disappointing when one loses, but you still have to look at the practicality of triggering a recount. Do you really have a shot at making up all of those votes or not? But I've also seen cases where in a recount for a local election, you end up with a tie and you have to figure out who the real winner is. And sometimes you actually have to pick a name out of a hat.
Or as I saw in one case, a sheriff's race in 1986, they flipped a coin.
Well, same thing as pulling a name out of a hat. Yep.
That is Vicky Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. We also heard from Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who told me today he's a very busy man. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.